This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 26th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll get the view from Johannesburg on violence in the Central African Republic and the South African troops killed there.
The fact is that the South African National Defence Force should never have been deployed in the Central African Republic. What has happened in the CAR is, of course, a complete disaster.
We'll ask about Russia's new order. What's the future of the country's oligarchs in the wakes of Boris Berezovsky's death? And we'll hear from Monocle's Accra correspondent on why Ghana may be turning to solar power on a super scale.
Today has been a fairly sort of power plentiful day, but at the moment we're sort of experiencing power shortages and some parts of the city water shortages on a regular daily basis at the moment, sometimes for up to 6 hours at a time.
All that, plus we'll play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, of course, it's news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
Angry workers from the largest Cypriot commercial bank, the Bank of Cyprus, marched to the Central Bank of Cyprus in Nicosia today to demand clarification about the banking restructure deal clinched with international lenders. Bank of Greece worker Theodor Kourougraris accused the government of colluding to break up the country's whole banking system.
There is no going back. Tomorrow the banks have to open. We have made mistakes, or the big powers to be have made mistakes. But now is not the time to make devious decisions behind boardroom doors, bringing in people to try and break the biggest bank of Cyprus.
The Italian Foreign Minister Giulio Terzi has announced his resignation, saying he didn't agree with last week's decision to send two Marines back to India to face trial for murder. Mario Monti's caretaker government on Friday reversed an earlier decision not to send the Marines back to face trial for the murder of two Indian fishermen during anti-piracy duty on a commercial tanker in February 2012. The United Nations Refugee Agency has made an appeal today to all parties in the Syrian conflict to ensure the safe passage of aid convoys in the country. The appeal comes a day after the United Nations said it will move about half of its 100 foreign staff out of Syria after mortar bombs fell near their hotel in Damascus, damaging the building and a UN vehicle. Adrian Edwards is a spokesman for the UNHCR.
UNHCR is today reiterating its appeal to all parties to ensure safe passage for convoys delivering humanitarian aid to civilians inside Syria. This is in light of the current security environment in which several convoys have had to be cancelled or delayed. The effects are that many Syrians are deprived of vitally needed aid. According to the UN's latest estimates, at least 3.6 million people are internally displaced in Syria. In addition, there are around 5.5 million people in need.
America's top court takes up the delicate and divisive issue of gay marriage today when the 9 Supreme Court justices consider the legality of a California ballot initiative that limits marriage to opposite-sex couples. Today will be the first of 2 days of arguments on the issue. On Wednesday, the court will consider the 1996 Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which limits the definition of marriage to opposite-sex couples. Rulings in both cases are expected by the end of June. Well, Paul Katami, one of the plaintiffs in the case challenging Proposition 8, said he was hopeful.
Like all Americans, we believe that the institution of marriage helps to build stable and strong families, and that's why we're here. Jeff and I long to be married and start a family of our own and have the equal rights that are guaranteed to all Americans that are in loving and committed relationships. And today marks the final chapter of a long 4-year journey toward that goal.
Heidi Rombola, however, is for Proposition 8. Proposition 8, she marched with hundreds of anti-gay marriage demonstrators.
It's really not about politics and it's not about equal rights. It's just about the definition of marriage and what it is. I feel sad that there's so much contention about it. I'm sorry that our homosexual friends feel that they're being deprived of something, but it's just the definition. You have to go with that.
Air France has unveiled its new low-cost hop fleet today, ready to take to the skies across France and Europe from the 31st of March. The airline was created through the merger of regional units Britair, Regional Air and Airlin Air. Air France President Alexandre de Juniac said there was a need to appeal to younger customers.
We need the marketing and commercial strength under a new brand name, which embodies, you know, dynamism, youth, creativity, marketing, new options, targeting all the public coming from everywhere for leisure, for business. We thought that there was a strong need, and we are sure that we will succeed.
And finally, a series of car ads, including one showing women bound and gagged in the trunk of a Ford driven by former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, has prompted internet outrage in India and prompted an apology from Ford India. The ads come just days after India approved a tougher new law to punish sex crimes. And that's the news from Monocle 24.
All right, thanks, Jonathan. It's 18:06 here in London, which means you're tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
All right, and you're tuned in to Midori House live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bound. The overthrow of President François Bozizé's government in the Central African Republic at the weekend has been making headlines around the world. Bozizé has fled to neighbouring Cameroon, but the situation inside the Central African Republic remains volatile. Looters and gunmen are reported to be roaming the streets, and there are fears spreading that a full-scale humanitarian crisis may not be far away. The coup's also been disastrous for South Africa, who lost at least 13 troops during the attack. Jacob Zuma and his ANC party are now facing questions about what these fighters were doing there in the first place and how they came to be defending President Bozizé against this attack. David Mania is a defence spokesman for South Africa's opposition party at the Democratic Alliance, and he had this to say earlier.
The fact is that the South African National Defence Force should never have been deployed in the Central African Republic. What has happened in the CAR is, of course, a complete disaster. And it's precisely for that reason that we have written to the Speaker of the National Assembly, Max Sisulu, requesting that he establish an ad hoc multi-party parliamentary committee to investigate the SANDF deployment in the CAR. The official reason for the deployment was that the SANDF would be responsible for capacity building of the defence force in the CAR. We have never believed that that explanation is plausible. The impression that was created was that the real reason that the SANDF had been deployed to the CAR was essentially to support or prop up the former president, François Bozizé. What is particularly intriguing about this case, and it is a matter which we think should be at the center of the inquiry, and that is that President Jacob Zuma took the decision to deploy the SANDF to the CAR, reportedly against the advice of the military command of the South African National Defence Force.
So that was the response of the opposition Democratic Alliance Party in South Africa, and that was their defence spokesperson, David Meunier. Joining me now on the line from Johannesburg to explore the story further is Peter Bruce, publisher of Business Day and the Financial Mail. Peter, thanks for joining us on the line.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, we talked in our introduction about this being a disaster for South Africa. Are we right or are we overplaying this?
I don't think you're overplaying it. I mean, South Africa is trying to project itself in the continent as a not so much a voice of reason, but as a reasonable diplomatic power, I suppose, able to solve difficult questions, having solved its own difficult questions, you know, 20 or so years ago. And It unfortunately, this particular, and I think David Main is absolutely right, this particular little adventure bears all the hallmarks of the Zuma administration, and to the extent that there is never any real clear explanation for why it happened in the first place. There'll be no explanation now, I can guarantee you, And neither will David Mania get his multi-party parliamentary inquiry underway. It will simply be deflected. The administration will just keep quiet about it. It is an inexplicable affair.
And how comfortable are South African troops about marching into another country? How comfortable are they doing it under the jurisdiction of Jacob Zuma?
Well, you know, there are South African troops in peacekeeping missions in the rest of Africa, and they do so as part of either UN missions or AU, African Union missions. This one appears to be a solo effort, as Mania was saying to you earlier on, mainly at the behest of Jacob Zuma. And I'm afraid that, you know, the questions that are going to be asked is, what irons did he have and what fires? There's no obvious reason. This is the difficult thing about it. There's no obvious reason why these people should have been there in the first place, let alone why they should have been killed. We're not going to get clear answers out of Zuma. He doesn't answer any questions because he's above mere political repartee. It's a mystery, and the tragedy is that, you know, 19, 20 people have lost their lives and their families don't have breadwinners.
And what's the press story in South Africa on this, Peter, in your own sphere? Are people pressing for an inquiry, for example?
Everybody's wanting answers. Everybody wants to know why they were there in the first place. We don't have an answer. Right at the moment, the president is in the middle of a BRICS summit in China, so he's playing host tonight, in fact, to President Putin of Russia, the president of China, Brazil, and India. And no doubt when all of that is out of the way, these questions about the mission in the Central African Republic will come back to haunt him, but for the moment he's sort of fairly safe and busy.
We know that the Central African Republic's rich in minerals. It's an asset worth guarding, or it's a friend worth keeping close to your breast, Peter. Is that the motivation for this, or is it a genuine peacekeeping mission that these troops are on?
I cannot think of anywhere else where it has done this on its own, without being invited by as part of a pan-African or UN effort. It's made really big cock-ups in French Francophone Africa recently. This is one of them. The other one was in the Ivory Coast, where they backed an unpopular president who had to be removed by his own people. And they seem to be sort of making heavy weather of diplomacy in their own backyard, and it shouldn't be that difficult to work out who the good guys and who the bad guys are. Everybody else seems to know, except the South African government.
Going back to the press story again, is there much of a discussion of the military tactics involved, what the troops themselves are physically doing on the ground there, or is it very much being played out as a diplomatic problem?
It started out as a diplomatic story, but the questions about, hang on a second, what intelligence were we using? Where was the support? Were these 400 troops simply dumped in the Central African Republic and left alone? Because we don't have the capacity as a country to supply a line that long. Apparently, there was lots of advance warning about this attack, and nothing was done about it. And that's simply because nothing could be done about it. We just are too far away to do this kind of thing, and the president or somebody may have to or will have to. It depends what the families do. They could take legal action, and the unions, the defense force unions, are very angry about it, and they may take action too. They're not unmilitant in their own way. So, you know, pressure could be brought to bear on the government to explain itself, but I doubt you'd ever get to the real truth, and the real truth will have something to do somewhere along the line with money.
Yeah, are most papers and most press outlets, media outlets, singing from the same hymn sheet on this? Or is there anyone pressing for greater engagement, that there should be more troops sent in the first place, for example?
No, nobody's asking for more troops to be sent there. Nobody knows anything. You know, Francophone Africa is a mystery to most South Africans. And the Central African Republic is not a place close to our hearts. We, as citizens, we were misled about what the Defence Force was doing there in the first place. We were told that soldiers were being employed rather than deployed to the CAR, and that they were going to be performing sort of functional duties like trainers and this kind of thing. Clearly, they were more than that. And if you listen to the story of how or the way it's being spun in this country now by the government, these people put up a brave fight against a huge onslaught of over 2,000 rebels. Obviously, in order to do that, they would have needed to be pretty well armed. But it's clear there was no support, and there can't be. There couldn't have been support. We don't have the equipment or the capacity to supply a line as long as from here to there.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you for joining us on the line from Johannesburg. That was Peter Bruce, a publisher of Business Day and the Financial Mail. Coming up, kind of change of pace. Why One Little Girl is changing Broadway's business model, Russia's New Order, and a half ton of bull.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage, and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dean.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
From the historic centre of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettner in the film section on monocle.com.
All right, it's 18:18 here at Midori House, coming to you live on Monocle 24. Germans can be forgiven for asking how it's come to this. At once, they're both Europe's saviour and Europe's villain. While providing hundreds of billions of euros to its neighbours, bailing out a continent, Germany also finds its leaders compared to Nazis and vilified in the popular press from Madrid to Nicosia. Part of the problem, argues Gideon Rackman, the FT's foreign affairs columnist, is the lack of other leaders in Europe. The Spanish and Italians are understandably more concerned with their own problems, while Britain isn't even sure it wants to be in the EU anymore at all. And then there's France. Nicolas Sarkozy may have been the junior partner in Merkozy, but at least he played a part. François Hollande most certainly has not. Gideon Rackman spoke with Steve Bloomfield earlier on today about this problem.
It's been very striking watching this whole week's kind of drama, how little role the French have played. I mean, in fact, I kind of only noticed them by their absence. You suddenly think, well, where are they? Because normally there will be the position of the French president and will be very important in any EU negotiation. And usually also there are French officials playing quite an important role because the French have been good at placing their top people in the high levels of the EU bureaucracy. But neither of those things seem to be obtaining at the moment. They're just out of it. And I think it's because Hollande is facing a weak economy at home, has an ambiguous policy towards Europe, on the one hand sort of condemning German-led austerity, but not really having a proper alternative or indeed trying to construct an alliance to push it back. And so he's just left looking like a bystander.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the fact that he hasn't really sort of come up with an alternative or built a coalition. I mean, when he was running for office against Nicolas Sarkozy, you know, he made it very clear that he wanted to see a real change in Europe, that, austerity in his mind wasn't working, which, you know, wasn't exactly an unpopular view elsewhere in Europe, that austerity wasn't working. And it was expected that he would, you know, somehow manage to be an alternative voice within Europe. Why do you think he's failed to provide that voice?
Well, I think partly he ran into reality very quickly. I mean, it was all very well to stand on the stump in, I saw him give quite a stirring speech against austerity in Bordeaux about 2 weeks before he was elected, and to say, you know, we're going to turn back these wrong-headed policies. But the fact is that they need, if they're going to bail out in the immediate time, the Cypriot banks or the Greek banks, or be able to construct a bailout fund that might work in Spain and Italy, they need German money. The Germans are the biggest economy, and so to simply say to the Germans, well, we don't like what you're going to do, you're going to have to change, it doesn't really work, because in the end there's a balance of economic and political power in which Germany is the most powerful player. And so Hollande had to settle for a kind of token face-saving twiddle to the fiscal pact, which was the issue of the day. In which the word growth was added as a kind of sop to the French, but no real change. And that's, I think, because in the way of politicians facing elections, he had raised unrealistic expectations about what he could do.
Now, certainly in the short term, it's possible that Angela Merkel and others within German leadership may see, you know, the lack of other alternative leaders is perhaps a good thing, because they can sort of push Europe in the direction they want. But long term, you think that this could be a problem for Germany as well?
Sure. I mean, I think so. You know, you're right. I think that they found dealing with the French, even dealing with Sarkozy, pretty irritating. And that's not even bringing the British or the Italians or the Spanish into the picture, because everybody's working under enormous pressure. The stakes are very high. And so, having, you know, in a way, the fewer internal negotiations you have, the easier it is to get things done. And yet, I think if the Germans look strategically, I mean, what is the point of the European Union? The whole idea was to end the German question, this question of, well, could Germany live peaceably with its neighbors? Is it too powerful to integrate into a Europe of nation states safely? And I think that for many years, it looked like the European Union was the answer, that you would create a Germany that was at ease in Europe and a Europe that was at ease with Germany. However, if we're now in a situation where it's very apparent that Germany is calling the shots in a situation of deeper recession, that's leading very clearly to German unpopularity. And I think it's causing resentment on both sides. The Germans, perhaps understandably, say, well, look, we're writing these vast checks. You know, you could at least be civil towards the country that's underwriting all this. But equally, you get the Cypriots or the Greeks saying, you know, they're destroying our economy and they're refusing to compromise, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a lot of ill feeling. And that, I think, raises in my mind the question of how long these structures are sustainable. If basically you have a European Union where the countries don't get on, really don't get on, I don't think it can work in the long run.
Well, it's sometimes hard when we're sort of lurching from crisis to crisis to look at the bigger picture and you know, the future of the European Union itself. But it is interesting when you look at, you know, for a generation, you know, we've talked about Europe being run in a sense with a German, Franco-British axis, all sort of, you know, the three countries all sort of needing each other in there to sort of ensure that that the others don't get too strong. But that axis now seems to have completely fallen apart, doesn't it? How does Europe operate without that sort of strong central core?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the British have been drifting away, really, arguably, ever since we didn't join the euro. We're now getting to the point where the political consequences of that are obvious. I mean, I think it was the right decision not to join the euro, incidentally, looking at what's going on. But it does have political consequences. It does lead to the marginalisation of Britain. And though I think Merkel and Cameron actually get on fine on the personal level, I think the Germans just think, well, you know, the British don't have much to contribute, either financially or, you know, intellectually. They're kind of in this bizarre, as the Germans see it, internal debate about whether we should leave the EU altogether. And the French, their irrelevance has become much more obvious since Sarko left office and Hollande came in for the reasons we were discussing. So without that triumvirate, Yeah, it's a very unfamiliar new EU, and an EU that as ever is trying to reinvent itself, but under pressure of events and of financial crisis, that makes it much more difficult to do it, but also much more urgent that they get it right.
And that was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to Gideon Rackman, the FT's foreign affairs columnist, a little earlier on. It's 18:25. It means you're tuned into Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Robert Bounds. Well, perhaps now it's time to change tune. Time for a little sing-song. I just spilt my glass of water with my flailing jazz hands. That was, of course, a clip from When I Grow Up, taken from Matilda the musical. The production's been hugely successful here in London, showing to packed theatres for the last 16 months and picking up a record 7 Laurence Olivier Awards in 2012. And if you're in New York, it's about to hit Broadway. On April the 11th, it'll open at the Schubert Theatre, and the assumption of its impending success across the Atlantic is so great that the RSC and Dodger Theatricals, who are behind the production, are driving a hard bargain for investors. None have received any production credits, and all will see a smaller return on their investments. So how safe is this assumption that Matilda will wow critics and audiences on Broadway? Joining me now is the only man that could possibly tell us, theatre critic for the IHT and regular Monocle contributor, Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Good to be here.
Nice to see you. Nice to see you again.
And you.
Now, this is a bit of a strange fish, isn't it? We said before we turned on the mics, the RSC bossing Broadway around.
Well, you know, Broadway musicals don't happen hit Broadway musicals, should we say, don't happen every day. It's like 1 out of 9, 1 out of 10 possibly pays back. That means there are a lot of flops and there's a lot of blood on the carpet, a lot of bad blood. And when there's the whiff of a Broadway hit, from wherever, whatever source, everyone wants to be part of it. Matilda first opened, and I saw it on a wintry night, almost as cold as tonight, in December 2010 in Stratford, where it was going to be the Christmas entertainment that year. It just took off like the proverbial comet and hasn't come down in the UK since then. This is the first time it's been tested outside of Britain, and people are just hoping that what has been a Lollapalooza, as we say in New York, in England, will be exactly that on the Great White Way. So the RSC, which is a state-funded entity, wants to make as much money from this as they can. And why shouldn't they?
And maybe we should touch on the play itself, coming obviously from a Roald Dahl novel that was presumably a big hit both sides of the Atlantic. We think maybe a bigger hit this side. It's kind of unusual fare for the RSC. As you said, it started off as their Christmas production. They can't have known what they had on their hands.
No, they didn't. And actually, I think that's one of the great things about the success of this show. So many West End and Broadway shows look sort of prepackaged, marketed to kind of fit some sort of preordained public, like The Bodyguard here at the moment, or even, God forbid, Viva Forever, which isn't hitting its target. This actually has succeeded incrementally, which I think is part of the thrill about it for those of us who love the show, and I'm sure is part of the thrill for those who created the show. It's unusual fare for Broadway, I suppose, because it's dark, it's subversive, it's twisted. It's about a little girl with telekinetic powers who has horrible parents. Her home life is not happy and sweet, but she finds a surrogate home life with her lovely school teacher, who's appropriately called Miss Honey. And so it's really about the fact that you choose the family you want. You don't necessarily connect with the family you're born into.
I guess this is like one of the stories of Broadway, one of the stories of the stage, and always has been, that you kind of fall in with a group, and that's kind of maybe better than where you came from in the first place.
Well, the funny thing about it opening on Broadway this season, and of course they've known this all along, the RSC, is that there is at the moment on Broadway a revival of the other famous musical about little girls, which is Annie, which originally was produced in 1977, and it's being revived on Broadway this year to sort of middling success. And Annie and Matilda have only one thing in common, which is that they're about girls. In every other way, they couldn't be more different. So I wonder if the Annie Brigade and the Matilda Brigade will overlap.
I wonder if there's going to be an Annie versus Matilda clash. I guess this is possibly how some people are going to write it up, right?
Well, it might be interesting for little girls who are auditioning for parts in New York. You don't get into Annie. Go up the road and see if you can get into Matilda. But the thing about it is the RSC, you know, doesn't have a home in London anymore. They used to be based at the Barbican and before that at the Old Vic. They've lost a lot of ground in PR terms to the National Theatre, the other great state-funded theatre in the UK. This is their big global moment to seize back some of the glory that in the 1980s was theirs virtually every year, every other year. Don't forget that they were the theater that in the UK first produced Les Miserables, but that was a quarter century ago. And, you know, if they don't strike well, the going is good this time, they might wait another 25 years.
Quickly and finally, Matt, I wondered what sort of bargains are being driven here, because I guess this is basically like backing the favourite in a horse race. You know, you go for a dead cert and you get very little back.
Well, first of all, the RSC was very careful about who it chose to be their Broadway producing partners. They went with Dodger Theatricals, who are the team behind Jersey Boys. Jersey Boys has been a huge global franchise, including in London. Its fifth anniversary performance is, in fact, tonight, which I'm going to.
I think that's where you've got to hot foot.
Yeah, that's where I'm hot footing. So they've chosen well, and they've also done something really interesting. They are not giving every single person who signs a check a producing credit. They will be what they actually are, investors, not producers, investors. The RSC are the producers, and they are letting everyone else know that.
All right, Matt, well, thank you as ever for joining us. I think I can hear your black taxi cab idling outside as we speak. In the next half hour of the show, we'll ask if the death of Boris Berezovsky signals a sea change in the fortunes of Russia's oligarchs, wonder what might become of Spain's most famous but recently deceased running bull, and check in with our man in Accra.
Today has been a fairly sort of power plentiful day, but at the moment we're sort of experiencing power shortages and in some parts of the city, water shortages on a regular daily basis at the moment, sometimes for up to 6 hours at a time.
But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Angry workers from the largest Cypriot commercial bank, the Bank of Cyprus, have marched to the Central Bank of Cyprus in Nicosia today to demand clarification about the banking restructure deal clinched with international lenders. The Italian Foreign Minister Giulio Terzi has announced his resignation, saying that he didn't agree with last week's decision to send two Marines back to India to face trial for murder. The United Nations Refugee Agency has made an urgent appeal today to all parties in the Syrian conflict to ensure the safe passage of aid convoys in the country. The appeal comes a day after the UN said it will move about half its 100 foreign staff out of Syria after mortar bombs fell near their hotel in Damascus. And Air France has unveiled its new low-cost hop fleet today, ready to take to the skies across France and Europe from the 31st of March. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, Jonathan. Sorry to get you sitting in the wrong seat there. We had a bit of a news switcheroo. You are back with Midori House Live on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, dit is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong. Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 1833 in London. You're tuned into Midori House with me, Robert Bound. Today's post-mortem results on Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky, which have confirmed that the cause of his death was hanging with no sign of violent struggle, may help draw a line under accusations of an assassination plot. But they also bring another question into the spotlight, whether his death marks the end of an era for Russian oligarchs, especially poignant as he died largely broke and longing for a country he was forced to flee. Well, joining me now to discuss whether we're seeing a shift in power back to the Kremlin is our Moscow contributor, Joshua Yaffa. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is an interesting sort of intellectual idea, this idea that perhaps the state is overtaking the man, the individual, and it's heading back to its sort of Soviet and pre-Soviet days. Is there any sense in this?
Absolutely. In fact, I would only add that is a process that's began years before, and in fact had culminated long before Berezovsky's death. The entire reason that Berezovsky was living in London and not Moscow was he lost a battle royale for influence and power with President Putin when he first came to office in the early 2000s. Berezovsky fashioned himself as a kind of kingmaker, of the Yeltsin-era Kremlin, thought he could do the same with Putin. Turned out the tables were turning on him, and he was forced to flee to London. So I would say his death is symbolically important, and that it adds a kind of final, somewhat poetic period at the end of the era of the powerful Russian oligarch. But in fact, it was an era that really had been fading out for some time.
And of course, the personalities at the sort of at the toppest of the top trumps of this pack of Russian oligarchs were Berezovsky, Roman Abramovich, and then I guess Putin right at the top of the pile as prime minister and president. Who are some of the other personalities that perhaps we haven't talked about? Who were some of the people that helped get Putin into power, for example?
Right. Well, Berezovsky, interestingly, was really the ringleader of a group of people around then-President Boris Yeltsin who were casting about for a successor. And Berezovsky thought he saw someone loyal, dependable, and safe in Putin. It turned out very quickly that Berezovsky had made a gross political and personal miscalculation, and very quickly in Putin's tenure as president ended up leaving the country. And many of the 90s-era oligarchs, it should be said, either also fled or essentially cashed out and left big business and are enjoying their lives elsewhere around the world. One figure whose fortune continued to rise as Berezovsky's declined was the person you mentioned, and that's Roman Abramovich, who, of course, is famous, at least in the UK, for being the deep-pocketed owner of Chelsea Football Club. He's known for that, too, of course, in Russia, but he's also become a kind of go-to fireman for the Kremlin when there's a big, high-level corporate struggle of one sort or another, when something gets very messy at the high levels of Russian business. He's been dispatched to go in and quiet all parties, to buy a stake in the company, get on the board, and to sort of manage the egos and personalities involved. So it's clear that in exchange for enjoying his fabulous wealth, he, Abramovich, understands there are some obligations, as it were, that come with that.
And it was the case, wasn't it, that Abramovich was very much sort of the sorcerer's apprentice underneath Berezovsky in the early days, and kind of overtook his old master, right?
That's absolutely correct. Berezovsky has said that he felt almost fatherly towards Abramovich in the 90s, showing him the ropes of the Russian business world in those rough and tumble days. And as you said, in this almost Shakespearean twist, at a certain point, the student outtook the master, and as Berezovsky fell from grace, Abramovich's star only rose. And the source of this grand dispute that was heard in London courtrooms was going back to a sale of an oil company between the two, sort of Berezovsky's final act of leaving the Russian business world and moving full-time abroad. He feels he was somehow swindled by Abramovich and the Russian state in that deal. And certainly being beat by Abramovich in English court last year, I think it's impossible to understand ultimately or know the psychology of Berezovsky, especially a man who apparently on the verge of killing himself finally. But that loss in the London courtroom seemed to be a blow, perhaps one blow too many for Berezovsky, and according to some friends and associates, sunk into quite the irreparable depression after that final defeat.
And Joshua, this golden age for oligarchs in the 1990s in Russia was sort of lampooned in a lot of other countries. It's sort of like a reliving of the Wild West in many ways. Have all these big financial killings been made, and is now up to the state to sort of claw them back, or at least make friends with the oligarchs that are left?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've seen under Putin is the kind of the quieting of the wild oligarchic capitalism that you saw in the 90s. Things are much less flashy, obvious, in-your-face, rude, and the kind of institutionalization, if that's the right word, of the oligarchy, of a real melding of the state and business worlds, but in a way that's much grayer, if you will. It happens behind the scenes. It happens with dour, very unpublic personalities. So I wouldn't say that the fortunes involved have decreased. I would just say that there's a kind of bureaucratic state-managed oligarchy that rules the Russian business and political world now, and it's much less comically and theatrically gauche and fabulous than it was in the 90s, which I should say, or it's worth remembering, from the perspective of your average Russian citizen, appears to be favorable. If you, according to most polling, you know, Russians appreciate the so-called Putin stability to the wild oligarchic 90s.
And just finally and quickly, Joshua, I don't know how quickly it is to do this one, but I wonder whether when I was in Russia before Christmas, I was in Moscow and in Siberia, a lot of people talked about the sort of the ineluctable desire to be sort of ruled by Russia. And I wonder whether this does show the power, the sort of power of the Russian state, whether it's Tsarist or Soviet or newly very capitalist, whether there is a sort of ineluctable suck of the state.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'm always hesitant to muse on the state of the Russian soul or anyone else's soul, rather, because I think Russians have endured an incredible century and even beyond of history that has left them with certain kind of embedded historical and cultural experiences. But what I would say about the current relationship of Russians to the Kremlin, to Putin, and certainly the relationship as it existed over the 12 or so years of Putin's rule, is there was a sense of relief at having a strong hand enter the Kremlin after a decade of kind of scarily all over the place politics. It wasn't clear who was making decisions. It wasn't clear how competent Yeltsin himself was, whether because of alcohol or age, and the influence and really dominance of these ultimately unelected oligarchic personalities. And this was also the time of economic crisis and financial crash and so on. So all of that in the Russian psyche, I think, was lumped together. And so to emerge from that into an era where there was at least a figure demonstrably and inarguably in control came as, I think, a relief to a lot of Russians in the early 2000s. Now, the appeal of that may have worn off by, say, December of last year, when we saw a protest movement break out in Moscow and some other large cities. But I think that sort of pact held for much of the 2000s, in which Putin provided a backdrop of stability and predictability for Russians in their everyday lives.
Okay,
in turn,
Joshua,
they give up a certain part of their political say.
Joshua Jaffa, thank you very much for joining us on the line from Moscow. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up, we check in with our Accra correspondent, Chris Lord, and mourn the death of a half-ton bull. But first, we're going to listen to From Russia With Love, so you can spot this one. It's Matt Monro.
It's true, I fly to you.
I don't know why we don't play that more often. I guess I do. That was, of course, From Russia With Love by Matt Monro. You're tuned in to Midori House at 18:45. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a sec.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
All right, you're back with Midori House. Monocle correspondent Christopher Lord recently packed up his bags and moved from Dubai down to Accra. Now settled into his new digs in the Ghanaian capital, news editor Tom Edwards checked in with Christopher to find out where its solar project has to do with the British and why the world's offshore oil industry has had its eyes on the country recently.
Offshore West Africa is a three-day event which sees delegates coming in from 35 countries to Accra. And really what the focus of the event is to discuss sort of oil and gas exploration in this wider region across West Africa, but also new tech for production. And it's been quite interesting this year. I mean, this is sort of a 17-year-old event itself anyway. But this year particularly seems to be focusing on sort of deep offshore technology, which is sort of the key point, but also the environmental impacts of this emerging sort of oil industry in West Africa. And I think one of the really interesting things to come out of here, I mean, you had lots of presentations by some of the big companies like Total and ExxonMobil and, you know, sort of big multinationals like that. But there was a very interesting conference about a four-year project between the Norwegian and Ghanaian governments. And essentially what this is to establish an environmental baseline off the Ghanaian coast. So to kind of create some sort of reference point for Ghana to understand how oil exploration and extraction is going to actually change the environment around the coast. Now, the collaboration between these two governments hasn't sort of come in isolation. I mean, they've been working together since 2012. And essentially what that's been is sort of overseeing role from Norway, giving some advice to Ghana about ways that it can extract its oil slowly and carefully and kind of minimize the impact on the fishing industry, which is something that Norway itself had to focus on in its own sort of beginning of its oil industry in the 70s. And it looks to be working pretty well. Some of the things that came out of that conference was the fact that 10% of Ghanaians are actually involved in the fishing industry. And obviously in Norway, it's a huge part of the workforce there as well. And so this survey sort of looked at soil samples up to deep depths, mapped the ocean floor, and tries to create some sort of significant reference point to basically avoid the looming specter of what happened in the Niger Delta in Nigeria.
And Chris, I just wondered from your sort of early experiences there, just anecdotally, do you think there is a real sense that with all of this great wealth and opportunity that can come from these new businesses, there is also that responsibility, there is that concern about the environment, preserving traditional livelihoods? Is that something of a preoccupation there? Because I guess to a certain extent in the Western media, it's often, we often cover, you know, the newly oil-rich nations, and it's often viewed as just a runaway train with no real regard for these other considerations. Is that your view there, or do you think there is a real interest in making sure that it's up to scratch on these areas as well?
I mean, it really depends sort of where you look to kind of get that from. I mean, from an official level, then yes. I mean, the political parties are very, very keen to kind of convince a huge proportion of the workforce here, of which many of them are involved in traditional sort of practices of work, you know, sort of rural agrarian practices or fishing. Then yes, then there's huge sort of party things like that. But if you read a lot of the news articles that are coming out, there is a growing concern about what's actually happening in the environment. I mean, I think everybody here is very concerned to make sure that Ghana doesn't become like Nigeria in that sense, in the way that, you know, Nigeria extracts its oil very, very quickly with some environmental sort of exploration and sort of baseline efforts in the 80s. But really, if we look at the situation that's happening in the Niger Delta with sort of sabotage coming in from various different rebel groups, people claiming ownership of various different parts of the oil field and generally causing a huge amount of sort of instability in that region, it's essentially what the oil production industry has done there. And I think Ghana's very, very concerned about that. You're right in as much as, you know, sort of traditional work sort of activity, they do want to protect it simply because they have to protect it. I mean, there's not a significant Ghanaian, I mean, there's the Ghanaian National Petroleum Company, but it's still growing, it's still very young, and there's not the jobs there in the oil industry to sort of maintain a huge number of people moved out of their traditional practices.
Now, let's turn and look at, well, I guess another area where some of those issues also reappear in terms of, you know, partisan press and cynicism, perhaps a little skepticism about government and government-controlled businesses, and that's about, well, power provision, I guess linked in more ways than one to oil and gas exploration. I gather there's a fair degree of, what should we say, disgruntlement in Ghana at the moment?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a huge amount of frustration really in the press and in the streets as well. I mean, in fact, you know, today has been a fairly sort of power plentiful day, but at the moment we're sort of experiencing power shortages and in some parts of the city, water shortages on a regular daily basis at the moment, sometimes for up to 6 hours at a time, certainly in the case of power. And this is really starting to rock the boat of the media here. I mean, when John Dramani Mahama came to power in July last year, after the previous president died in office, there was a sort of, you know, there's been a little bit of a feeling that these shortages have sort of really picked up since he came to power, certainly in some of the papers that align themselves with the opposition parties. But today, President Mahama actually sort of went out and spoke to editors in Accra, and he sort of basically said that he recognised the deficit of sort of around 250 megawatts of energy, which the country needs, which seems at the minute sort of a little bit slim. I mean, they're really sort of looking at the moment to become this middle-income country. And we were talking before about the oil and gas sector and all these different different things and these very lavish conferences that are happening over here. And I think there's a concern about, you know, if we can't nail power production and we can't get our sort of energy sector sorted, then how can we kind of expect to really push forward with a lot of these big projects? And I think that what some of the editorialists were saying was, look, you know, we're lacking power here, we're lacking water, we have to do something, we can't just sort of wait for it to get better.
And Chris, tell me about some of the other nations and companies, indeed, who are getting involved in some potential solutions to this kind of project. I gather there's a big solar project taking place there, and that does involve some expertise and input from overseas.
That's right, yeah. I mean, at the moment, there's a lot of electricity in the region, sort of in Ghana, Benin and Togo, the sort of two surrounding countries here. A lot of electricity comes from the Akasombo Dam, which is in Ghana and was built in the 60s. And so that provides a significant amount of electricity, and there are smaller hydro projects going on around the country. But there's also a massive solar energy project forthcoming, which is actually going to be the biggest solar project in Africa. And this is being put together by a British company called Blue Energy, which was announced in December last year with work to begin in the next few months. So that does kind of present a real sort of opportunity to push forward that capacity. I think we have to remember as well that, you know, we were talking before about traditional industries, and I think, you know, Ghana really relies on a lot of cottage industries here. So if you're a tailor or you're a sort of informal food shop on the side of the road, or what they call spots here, which are small informal bars, and you suddenly can't do your business anymore because the power goes out, really the situation arises that waiting for the biggest solar plant in Africa to come online, really the situation needs to be resolved now. And I think that that's the mood that you really get from the press here.
And that was Monocle's Accra correspondent Christopher Lord speaking to news editor Tom Edwards at Alernia. It's 1851 here in London. You're tuned in to Midori House.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, to my Monocle 24.
Tra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's So Monocle 24. This is Midori House. It's 1852 in London. I'm Robert Bound. We're coming to you live from Studio One. He weighed half a ton. He's killed three men. And on Sunday, only 2 years into his retirement, he died. He is Raton, Spain's most infamous fighting bull. During his seven-year career, he developed a reputation as a fearsome beast, though his name, meaning mouse, was given to him because he was born so small. He was the subject of an official biography and was featured as a video game character and will now be embalmed, stuffed and put on display in a museum in Valencia. For an insight into Raton's importance in Spain and the future of one of the more controversial sports in Europe, we're joined on the line by Almudena de la Maza, ranch owner and breeder of the famous Conde de la Maza bull. Almudena, thank you for joining us on Midori House.
Okay, thank you very much.
Did you shed a tear when Raton hit the dirt for the last time?
Not at all, I'm afraid. Not at all.
How come? He was a bit of an icon, was he not?
Well, but he was an icon. The thing is that you have to realize that although he was a fighting bull, he was not fought in a formal arena, in a formal bullfight. He was more destined for bull dodging, street feasts, parties, drunken events, that kind of thing.
So he was more the, when we see the running of the bulls and people kind of getting their arses gouged as they run down the streets, he was more into that kind of thing than the bull, the traditional bullfighting with the matadors, the toreadors, that sort of thing.
No. So he wasn't, he just did like bull dodging, which is very, very important in the Valencia, you know, in the Levante area, on that part of the Mediterranean. And it's very much part of the popular tradition in towns and villages.
So is this more of a grassroots form of the end of bull sport in Spain than the more sort of Colosseum events?
Exactly. You said it. It's more popular. It's more grassroots. It's more let's get pissed and let's see who dodges the bulls best.
Okay. And obviously three people didn't manage to dodge the bull. Is this a high rate of success for a bull such as Raton? Is that why he was such an iconic creature?
I think it's well. The danger, I mean, he must have been a very intelligent animal that learned very well how to avoid the dodging, as it were. And obviously he was extra risky, and people like that. People need the adrenaline high, and they wanted to face that bull. So that's why he was so popular.
And it's a bit like when people go fishing, they obviously want to catch the biggest fish, or they want to re-catch maybe a particularly aggressive shark that's been caught. Is that the same? Is it the same vibe with bull running in Spain, that people obviously want to get in the ring or on the streets with a bull like Raton and face such a formidable foe?
And say that you've survived it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's basically looking for the adrenaline high.
And is this we talked in the introduction about possibly having a chat about the future of the sport as well. Does this have a more of a bright future than the traditional bullfighting that maybe at least in the UK we're more familiar with and is a bit more of a controversial sport?
Well, the thing is that the traditional Spanish bullfighting ends with the death of a bull, and Raton was so clever because he actually learned through experience. You know, by continuously going to the same places and dodging human after the other, and learn to cut the dodging. That, you know, that's what I mean. So he learned from experience, and he became very dangerous because of the experience he had. In traditional bullfighting, in a bull ring, that's it. You go in, and you know, the bull goes in, and he leaves on his back dead 20-25 minutes later.
And we heard that that Raton could command fees of 20,000 euros or so to turn up at one of these events. Presumably his owner was a rich person. How well looked after would Raton have been? Did he arrive in a beautiful horse box? Was he lauded? Did people want to pat his snout as he walked through the town?
You don't get close to an animal like that.
He's that aggressive that he even when he's before he's G'd up he's unapproachable.
The thing is that it comes natural to them. They don't need to be cheered up or anything. He's out there hunting. You know, if he goes in the middle of the town square with the barriers and the men teasing him, well, men could be women if they're crazy enough. For him, it's a sport.
And how's this being reported in Spanish newspapers, Almudena? Is there a sense of mourning, or is there a sense of celebration at his larger-than-life existence?
I think it's more an anecdote because obviously he has as much fame inside the borders of Spain as outside because of that. Well, if the press decides to talk about it, but and also his colouring was very peculiar, so he was unmistakable. You know. So he was well known. So I suppose people from the Levante, some of them will actually be able to go to the local feasts more relaxed now and be able to show off in front of their girlfriends because they don't have to face Raton.
Okay, well, areas of Valencia are a little bit safer. Almudena de la Maza, Spanish ranch owner and breeder, thank you very much for talking us through the spirit, the legend of Raton. And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producers, Katie Bilbao and David Michon, our researchers, Fernanda Augusto-Pacheco and Annabelle Bly, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Next up is our weekly design show, Section D, where our researcher, Fernando Pacheco, will be dropping in on the Ideal Home Show here in London to discover the world's first quiet house.
I think there's a big gear shift going on that is happening amongst the architects, the home builders, that we will be designing homes that can support and comfort our living experience rather than take away from that to support our oral health.
And then at 2200 hours later on in the schedule, Andrew Muller will be helming the Monocle Daily, so stay tuned for that. It just leaves me to say thank you very much for tuning in.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.